You're listening to 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio, coming to you live from the north side of Lexington, Kentucky. Hopefully you're all staying dry out there. It's very wet. The remnants of Hurricane Harvey will be arriving tonight. So in case you didn't know, Night Market is canceled, rescheduled to September 22nd. So just letting you know. So if you show up, you can hang out, but you might just be standing in the rain by yourself.
Yeah.
And that great Foley art was provided by our special guest here. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, this is John Lackey from Homegrown Press Studio and Gallery, kind of across the street from here.
I was going to say thank you for, you know, taking the long journey to come down here.
I had to cross two streets.
It's nice. So John Lackey is the owner of Homegrown Press, also a musician, poet, so many other things, filmmaker. So John, how's it going?
Good.
Excellent. So John, I want to ask you, first of all, you know, I think for folks that don't know you, where are you from?
I'm from here in Lexington. Mm-hmm. Except for a couple of times when I flunked out of art school, working at lumber yards in Los Angeles and Nashville and hitchhiking around the country, I've lived here my whole life.
Wow. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Sarah for 13 years.
Nice.
My dad taught there, and back then, faculty kids could go there for free. So I did, and it wasn't. It's like a nice little college now. Back then, it was kind of like a Cheech and Chong movie.
Oh yeah, how can you explain that a little bit more?
Have you seen a Cheech and Chong movie?
I have, yeah.
Or a Harold and Kumar movie?
I have, yeah.
It was, you know, the buildings were older and the rules were laxer and the hair was longer and it was
a little more free. If you
yeah,
were.
A little more Dazed and Confused than Rushmore. Or,
nice.
You know.
Well, that's cool. So after you went to high school, what did you go to school? You went to college?
Yeah, I went to UK for art school and was kind of intimidated by it because I hadn't really studied art, but I knew I wanted to be an artist and everybody seemed to know what they were doing. And it took me years to realize they didn't really. And so it was good to flunk out of art school and be made humble and have different experiences. I sold cars for a while, which I thought was a failure as an artist, but I learned a lot of stuff about human nature that's useful as an artist and a person and a business person.
Yeah, and it seems like nothing will motivate you to work on the craft that you love more than a mundane task to have to do every day.
Or a crabby fiance.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, well, that helps too. It's another kind of job, for sure.
Yeah.
So so when you were at art school, you know, what were you, because your art is so kind of multidisciplinary, you know, you're doing printmaking, you're doing painting, you know, you're doing
well, at first I just
stuff.
Flunked in and out of it and really did end up at working in lumber yards in Nashville and Los Angeles. And
how'd you end up down there?
Well, the cranky fiance told me that I needed to get a better job if I wasn't going to be in school. And she said, they're hiring at 84 Lumber. So I went and they said, yeah, we're hiring for Nashville.
Wow.
And I said, I'll take it. So that was, you know, the end of art school for a while and the end of the fiance. And just started learning computers and hauled lots of lumber and got to live in a little bit different part of the country for a while. I thought it wasn't that different, but I was loading up lumber for a little old farmer one day, and he was leaning against his trunk, squinting at me, chewing tobacco, and he said, John, where are you from, boy? And I said, Kentucky. He goes, I knew it. Effing Yankee. And I started to laugh, and I realized he was still squinting.
Wow.
He wasn't laughing.
Yeah.
And so I thought, oh, wow, I'm a Yankee now.
Wow.
Everything's relative.
Yeah. Well, it's a learning experience for sure.
Yeah. You know, and then the lumberyard in L.A., me and a friend listened to too much California music and got all carried away and moved to Los Angeles and had a big time for a little while. And he's still there. He really wanted to live there. And I ended up learning that I like Northern California a whole lot more and didn't stay out there real long.
Mm-hmm.
But it was another experience, seeing the West for the first time.
Yeah, I always think about Barry Lopez's Landscape Shapes Mindscape. And I think place is played such a huge role in your art, particularly your, you know, portraits of Kentucky in different areas. So, you know, do you feel like that experience of traveling and hitchhiking and heading from Nashville and L.A. really kind of inspired you, not just on, from an existential level, but from seeing all those different places and how people live?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was flunked out of art school yet again, and was just, it really was just kind of a bum and a ne'er-do-well, or mostly not do well. And started going to, Bob Dylan was touring with the Grateful Dead, and I had some friends who were Deadheads, and they said, "You have to go to a show." And I said, "Do I?"
Yeah.
And so I went, and then just kind of got carried away and never came home for quite a while. Just started hitchhiking around the country and living off the good graces of some crazy gypsies who took liberties with the world.
Yeah, and that's really where Homegrown Press started, right? Is kind of selling art while touring with the Grateful Dead.
Yeah, I saw people selling really crappy artwork in parking lots, and I thought, well, I could do that. So I started, I borrowed paper and ink and started making hand-drawn tape covers, which it was a start. And borrowed thread from people and learned how to weave those weird little bracelets and got pretty good at that. And then started screen printing and would screen print in campgrounds or hotel rooms or parking lots or rest areas. I had a screen and a board to stretch shirts on and would get a ride to Kmart and buy a bunch of those 3-packs of white undershirts and just screen print them in a campground and take them to the next show and sell them, just my artwork on. And eventually I got pretty good at it, but pretty skinny and a little just wore out and hitchhiked home and went over to UK to see if I could get in school, and it already started, and my grade point level was underwater, and met a nice lady named Jane Johnson who helped me get academic bankruptcy. I wiped out all my grades but kept my credits and got me in classes late, and then met Debbie Fredericks, who was a professor at UK, who said, "Hey, have you ever tried printmaking and carving block prints?" She thought I would like it, and I fell in love with it and majored in printmaking and minored in graphic design, because at that point I'd met my wife at a dead show in North Carolina, and we were starting a family, so I had the minor in graphic design, and did end up getting a job in at a TV station as an artist, and then another TV station as the art director, and kind of worked my way up to that, and then quit that about 16 years ago to just start making art full time. And it's been a bumpy plane taking off, and been a lot of wheel damage and bent fuselage, and but I'm starting to get a little starting to get some serious air finally after all these years. It feels pretty good.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, and our eyeballs are very happy to that you made that decision to leave the TV station to focus on your art.
Yeah.
It's great. So, John, I want to ask you a little bit more just about touring around with the Dead and kind of that experience. You know, for folks that don't know, kind of, you know, at that point, what was that environment like? Like, were there tens of thousands of people traveling with them?
It was very clean, very quiet.
Yeah, a lot of
the bathroom facilities were awesome.
A lot of bow ties.
Yeah, the porta potties at the Meadowlands in Jersey in the 105 degree summer swelter were lovely.
New car scent air fresheners dangling above.
Porta potty attendants.
Yeah,
mints.
So like the I guess
turns out they weren't mints.
Yeah, it's true. Not very delicious. And why did they put them in the urinal? I don't get it.
Just, you know, trying to hippies.
Yeah. So John, I guess the artistic community that was traveling around with the Grateful Dead, you know, did those people go into the shows and ever watch it, or was it kind of like a, you know, like a market outside of the
show? You know, it was like the world. It was both and in between, and you know, a whole bunch of different kinds. It ran the gamut. There was no matter where you were in the country, there was always some guys going, "Get your Grateful Bot shirts," and they weren't trying to talk like Mo. They had T-shirts they made up with Bart Simpson with dreadlocks, and they were selling Grateful Bot shirts.
Grateful Bot shirts.
And that they were from wherever Mo's from, because they really talk like Mo. Like, "Get your Grateful Bot shirts." Those guys never went in the show.
Yeah.
They wanted to make money. There were people that liked to travel and make money. I always wanted to go in the shows because it was really inspiring, because, you know, I fell in love with a lot of the songs, and the Dead were kind of in a resurgence halfway through my freewheeling times following them around.
Are there any Dead shows that really stick out to you, like maybe the one you met your wife at?
Well, at that same show, I saw Greg Brady walking through the hallway in Madras shorts and a tie-dye, looking so happy. And he didn't look like Greg Brady, but I'd seen him on a TV interview, so I knew what he looked like. And I really wanted to go down and bother him, but he looked so high and so happy, I just left him alone. But yeah, there were the six shows they did, three on each coast with Bob Dylan, where they backed him up, and they made him learn all his old songs because they were such Dylan freaks.
Wow.
He writes about it in his book Chronicles. He was still, that was a real good period for him because they put their back into backing him. And his, I think he had a new girlfriend because he really was singing like a bird. He really, and you could see there was somebody in the front row he was kind of singing too. So I think maybe he had a new girlfriend or something. But he really brought it, and they played. There was a lot of times like that, and just shows on the road with friends. Lots of great moments. Lots of great moments. Just, you know, dancing with a bunch of crazy people in a frenzy under a sky in Oregon, and then going out in the parking lot and everybody kind of gleaming and happy and drinking beers and eating falafels and walking around with their dogs. They were all, every night there was, you'd always hear two girls in the parking lot so excited to meet each other because our dogs both had the same name, which was the name of, you know, some Grateful Dead song, like Cassidy, and they'd be so surprised every time.
Well,
but just, yeah, getting to see the West and getting to see a lot of freaky people that lived in a kind of an old-timey way and, you know, built wooden tops on their buses and could fix anything and were just kind of resilient and...
like influential as a nomadic collective.
Yeah, you know, before it started becoming a thing, before they started having hits again in the later 80s, you know, some of those people had enough of the excitable young karma coming in that wasn't exactly so kind. And so some of those people kind of dropped off and probably got jobs and grew up like I did eventually. But it was invaluable and beautiful and tied with place because they're from the great Northwest, you know, Northern California, and tied in with Kesey and Oregon and all that stuff. So it was nice to, after reading lots of books like On the Road and Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, it was nice to see some of that life, get to live some of it. And there were some horrible times hitchhiking too that were dangerous and scary and funky and really ill-advised.
Yeah, can you tell us about some of them? Are there any in particular where you're like, what am I doing?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, one of the best ones, and now that there's Facebook, some of these people I thought I'd never, ever see again. You know, some of them are living in Hawaii, and they're like, hey, what's up? And it's like, I thought...
Remember that time we met?
You know,
and
I would have bet $50 you were dead.
Yeah.
But hitchhiking from a Dylan show in New York to a Dylan show in Oregon, halfway across the country after all these crazy rides and some ups and downs, got a ride with a guy named Skeeter who had his dad's Stanley Steamer van.
Wow.
And he was supposed to be driving to L.A. for a family reunion, and I talked him into going up to the Dylan Dead show in Oregon.
Wow, so he skipped the family reunion?
Well, no, we got up to Idaho or somewhere, and I could see the panic in his face, like, who is this crazy person? What am I... And these people kept driving next to us in a Ryder or a Penske moving truck, like one of those big moving trucks. And there's these hippies driving it. And they kept waving and getting up even with us. And we talked to them at a rest area. And they were going to the show. And so I got passed on to them.
Wow.
And followed the dead around with them. They were this family from Connecticut who had rented a giant moving truck for one day and then followed the dead around for months.
And never took it back.
Well, until they dropped me off to meet a friend in Venice Beach at the end of that tour. And then I found out a couple months later that they had been pulled over right after they dropped me off, and cops with shotguns had made them all lay face down on the ground.
Wow.
And it was a pregnant mom and her three kids and her ne'er-do-well husband and her brother and a band from Connecticut and a bunch of dogs. And
wow.
But this guy, he was really good at slipping out of situations. Mm-hmm. I saw him slip out of lots of situations. Wow. So he ended up free again.
And connected with you.
Yeah.
And Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. It's funny how things like that come back around.
It is.
Never think.
It is. Well, they dropped me off and I met my friend, and he had tickets to go see the Red Hot Chili Peppers in 87 when Hillel Slovak was still in them. So we got to go to the Pasadena Opera House and see the Chili Peppers in their socks and in their day glow and in their youth, in our youth.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot of connections between, you know, the Northwest and California and Kentucky as well, you know.
Oregon, it seems a lot like Kentucky.
Yeah, a lot of water.
That beautiful coastline.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, all the running water. But I'm thinking about, like, Ed McClanahan and Gurney Norman, you know, of just that Kentucky connection to Stanford and all those folks, you know. I think there's something about Kentuckians inherently where we like to leave and we like to explore places and see what's out there. And we always ultimately end up coming back, you know.
Grass is always greener.
It's
true. No, it's not.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So John, I'm curious, you know, what artists when you were growing up or when you were studying at UK were really influencing you? Who were some folks who, you know, inspired you to create and be a visual artist?
I've always liked timeless people who you see their stuff and it's like they're winking at you from the past. They're not stuck in their time.
Mm.
Like Albrecht Dürer.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and plus he could paint, he could etch. Yeah. I mean, he could just do whatever.
He could invent animals.
Well, I kind of feel the same way because people always say, oh, you do this art and that art. And a lot of times there's kind of a little side eye like, you know, you need to stick to a lane.
Yeah.
And I understand that because, you know, you can get spread too thin. And I come close to that sometimes. But to me, it's just all stuff that has to come out. It's all Play-Doh. And you're a Play-Doh fun factory for people that remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a different star-shaped hole. It's a music-shaped hole or a painting-shaped hole. And it's just stuff coming. You know, you do... You know, comedy and art and writing and performing and music.
Yeah, it's, you know.
It's all the same thing.
It's just a different vehicle.
It's just stuff coming out. Better out than in.
It's true. Absolutely, yeah. And the catharsis is what art is really all about, you know, of sharing your individual thoughts with other people and saying, hey, I think that too, because I think you probably do too, you know. But yeah, I think there's no difference between syntax or a palette, you know, of paints.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a different medium of building.
Well, plus being an art director using Photoshop and Illustrator all the time, I learned, because mainly I'd done black and white block prints in school. That's mainly what I did. So, and I'd never painted. So using the slider bars on the screen to mix colors in Illustrator and Photoshop, it showed you mathematically what percentage of each color is made up of the basic colors.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of learned to mix color from a computer.
Like E color theory.
Yeah, yeah. E color theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, eye palette.
Or color theory E,
if
you will.
Oh.
Yeah, somebody can market that. Yeah, sorry. Anyway, the show just got canceled. No, I'm just kidding. So, John, I wanted to, you know, continue on. You know, so you came back after touring with the Dead and came back to UK and ended up graduating with a degree in art studio.
Mm-hmm.
Great. And so after that, what happened? What'd you do next?
We moved out to the country, out Pisgah Pike, and had a couple little kids, rented a farmhouse out in the middle of an apple orchard in the middle of a kind of scraggly horse farm.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife got a job, and eventually I kind of woke up and got a job. I mean, I've worked since I was eight. Mm-hmm. I worked for my grandfather, helping with this fire alarm company.
Mm-hmm.
And worked at Baskin Robbins. I've worked at a million restaurants, Alfalfa's being the favorite place I've ever worked.
Mm-hmm.
And been a janitor. And so I've always had jobs, but you know, you start getting more serious when you start having a family.
Definitely. And I wanted to ask you a little bit more about your connection to Alfalfa, because I know it's very personal. And I mean, you designed the logo, obviously.
I used to work at the UK Art Library. And nobody ever came in there except for Jake Gibbs.
Mm-hmm.
He came in there because nobody ever came in there, and he could read or take a nap or whatever in between his classes teaching at BCTC. And I was, you know, I didn't have that many shifts. I mainly sat around and partied a little bit and did mashups of Escher and Klimt and stuff like that on the copy machine, kind of sampling visually.
Klescher. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I like that. And Jake said, well, I got a restaurant, and you know, you could work there if you want. And if, for some reason, I'd never heard of Alfalfa's. It was just on the other side of campus and just didn't know about it. And I was getting ready to cut my hair off and try to get a straight job. And he said, well, I, you could have a job there. And I said, what do you got? And he goes, well, I got one dishwashing shift a week. And I said, well, I'll take it. So I started washing dishes there and eventually started cooking a little bit and waiting tables. And it was just a family of wonderfully gorgeous misfit toys. Anarchists and writers and dancers and
like the parking lot at a dead show.
Yeah,
running a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. Except for there were black people too.
No, I see. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, the dead shows meant well, but it was a little, it was a little pale,
little whiteout,
little pale.
Yeah,
but Alfalfa's was, it was just wonderful. Just cranks and artists and wonderful people, some of whom still work there, and that was 30 years ago. So it was a family for sure. We had parties and it's cool. Where we live right now, right across the street, a bunch of women from Alfalfa's used to live there, and they had the baby shower for my wife when she was pregnant 26 years ago.
Oh, across the street.
Right across the street, so we can look and see the porch that all those ladies were sitting on, and it is a warm thought to have sitting in the, on our front porch.
It's cool. Comes back full circle.
Yeah, yeah. And then Jim Happ, who was one of the owners when I got my job there, and eventually everybody sold out and got tired and busy, and he maintained it. And even though he lives in California and has a giant job where he flies around the world, he owned Alfalfa's with his wife Betsy for the past many years, all those years, and he finally just sold it because he found some good people whose hands to put it into. But a fun little story about meeting Jim was Jake said, hey, two of the owners live up in upstate New York, the owners of Alfalfa's, and when you're hitchhiking around, if you get up that way, you should go check them out. They have a antique store in an old church. So I hitchhiked up there and was walking around this old church and looking in the windows to make sure I had the right church before I just walked in and got shot.
Yeah.
And this big tall guy answers the door and he goes, hey man, come on in. And a bunch of intellectuals and hippies a little older than me were in there all sitting around talking and eating. And he goes, you want a grilled cheese sandwich? And I said, sure. So we sat there eating and we talked and drank beer for a couple hours. And then finally Jim goes, by the way, man, who are you?
How many minutes in was that?
A couple hours.
Wow.
Yeah, and so we've gotten to be...
I like that the grilled cheese came before self-introduction.
That's
philosophy.
That's how it is, you know? Those people were very warm go-getters, you know, not without their irony and sarcasm and acerbic wit, but can-do people who can do anything and fix things and run things. And it was a good group of people, and for me a good group of men to kind of have as examples that lost souls can find themselves and grow up without caving into society's pressures to conform.
Yeah, and be who you are, you know. And, you know, that's something I talked a little bit about with Ed when he was on here, too. And, you know, I'm curious if you felt that way when you were traveling around with the dead and you ended up back in Kentucky, did you bring that culture with you, that counterculture, and how did, you know, your family or people who were...
I brought some funk home.
Yeah.
Of all sorts.
How was the transition kind of coming back from that kind of nomadic counterculture world to a more strict, rigid Kentucky?
A
little different.
You know, I mean, most of the people I hung around here with weren't that strict or rigid.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Lexington's gotten so cool these days. It's so much fun, and it's really come awake and alive. All the stuff that's going on around here, and people like Seedleaf, and you know, the better things that West 6 is doing, and you know, it's just so much fun. And I think this has got to be better than out west.
Yeah.
But then we went out to Portland to visit some friends and go to Pickathon last year, and the West Coast is. It's so beautiful and nice, and it's, you know, everybody's kind of on the same page in certain places, certainly in Portland. Which after a while I was thinking, well, who the hell am I going to argue with here? I got to go back to Kentucky.
This craft beer is less delicious.
Yeah.
This beer brewed with lavender is not
it's like
as
everybody's
enjoyable.
Been brainwashed to be reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wonderful and it's what we should shoot for, but it's not always exciting.
It's like the next manifest destiny, you know, a more of a philosophical manifest destiny to some degree.
Yeah. But I do like trying to bring a little of that here. You know, enlightenment and color and tall trees and you know. Why, you know, I think most of the people, I mean, I'm working on that movie, and one of the things I kind of want to shine a light on is the musicians and creative people in this town, you know, who are middle-aged, who have left town and come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Warren Byram going to New Orleans and Chris Sullivan living in a fishing boat off the coast of Alaska at night in a little boat. That would be my nightmare.
Yeah.
But these people traveling around, and they went away because this always hadn't historically been a great place for creative people or free thinking people.
Mm-hmm.
Much more so now than it used to be.
Definitely.
There used to be little pockets of weirdness, like really wild drag queens that had great punk bands and owned really cool bars, you know, and alfalfas. There was pockets of cool, you know, little islands to swim and cling on to that made it palatable to be here back in the day.
Then Hunter Thompson say, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro.
That's true.
It's Lexington. Yeah.
Yeah. But like all those musicians and everybody that have left and come back, and now they're putting out the best work of their lives. They're making these stellar albums, you know, Andy Mason, all these other people, Otto Helmuth, that there's really something to be said, you know, there's something to be gleaned from what they've done, because, you know, the soil they grew up in here is very important. But then going away and getting different seasonings for it.
That's a great way to describe it.
And then coming back.
Yeah.
And just to not giving up the creative life, because, you know, like for me, I can't do anything else. I you live once, I want to spend my life doing it. And I've done everything else, and it's kind of made me a little crazy, and this makes me a little less crazy. It kind of unplugs the crazy just enough to keep going day to day. But what these guys and gals here in town, because there's so many good musicians, you know.
Yeah, I was just talking.
Reva and Kim, and singing with John Ferguson and Big Fresh and all these people. There's so much good stuff going on. I'd like to shine a light on what that is. You know, these people that have left and come back, and how in middle age they're making the best art of their lives. You don't always see that coming, and it doesn't always happen. And I feel like I'm making art for the people who tried and then had to go back to real life, for lack of a better term. I feel like I'm doing it for them, like a boxer who had lots of friends who boxed, and not everybody wants to keep getting punched in the head. But that's kind of, you were talking about what I gotta fall in the dead around. Sometimes they really transcended the earthly and made beautiful music. Sometimes it could be a train wreck. Not a train wreck. They were all really good professionals who had played together for 30 years.
But sometimes maybe a little less utopian.
Envisioned. You know, you could tell maybe they were kind of pissed at each other, or Garcia was getting funky again.
Yeah.
But sometimes they transcended and it was beautiful. But a lot of times it would be like watching a boxing match with Muhammad Ali in his later years. You're like, I don't know if you need to be doing this, but God, go.
Yeah.
And you'd be rooting for him, and it's like, oh, don't die, don't fall down. And with Jerry Garcia, it was like that. Because he'd be up there, and he just looked like somebody's grandma having a heart attack half the time. And he'd just play through it. I mean, he was a tough bird. He'd be up there in the sun in Las Vegas or wherever, playing in 110-degree weather, or Northern California, just sweating it out like everybody else. And never wore shorts until the last 2 years of his life.
Wow.
Like maybe ever.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody always joked that he always went around shirtless. He just had a black shirt tattooed onto him.
That's hilarious.
But watching him was like watching a boxing match. He'd get on top of it. You know, he'd ride it out and maintain and not miss beats in the song, and make long, pretty solos that were inspiring, even when you could tell he was really not feeling well. And it was, you know, I played a lot of sports growing up and liked those analogies, and it was watching him gut it out and rise to the occasion was inspiring.
Yeah, an example of, you know, persistence, an example of doing what you do, you know. I think a lot of people sometimes, and, you know, I think about Marco Rubio's quote where he said, we need, less philosophers and more welders, you know, and I think that binary approach to value in a job or in anyone's profession is absurd and clearly shows that you've never delved on the other side.
People just don't know if they don't know.
Yeah,
you got to have some compassion for them, but, you know.
Art is work.
Well, they need to put more money into education so kids can, so they can have art and music classes so their minds can be expanded and they can learn to think for themselves and be self-determined, because modern society gives them tools they could use for that, but it's being used to kind of make them fall in line. You know, everybody's scrolling through the same stuff on their phones, and it's particularly horrible for kids who aren't formed yet. I was kind of a jerk about my kids' electronics, because every new electronic that we're fighting these days kind of came about riding the same wave of my kids' age.
True.
And both my kids love to read books more than anything now. And I think if I hadn't been kind of a jerk and a hard ass, you know, any minor infraction meant no video games for a couple of days.
So
I kept them from getting addicted. It's hard these days. So they really, in education, they need to have art and poetry and dancing and stuff where you make stuff.
Yeah.
So you learn to drive your own boat. A lot of people are expecting somebody else to drive the boat these days, and they're not self-determined and they can't think reasonably and coherently.
Yeah.
You know, they're used to being fed.
Yeah. It's a fight against your own uniqueness, your own unique voice. And I think that's where the real misnomer is that art is some easy task. You know, art is work, and you're really trying to take all of the crazy things occurring in the world currently at that time and figure out a way to represent them or show them or to tell your thoughts or your character or who you are, you know, through paint or through music or through whatever medium it might be. I think it takes both. I think the world needs welders and artists, you know,
and I know
a lot of welders who are artists, you know.
Well, people used to grow up on farms and they had to fix machinery and they had to get up early. They had to have empathy. They had to have gumption.
Yeah.
You know, they earned their fried chicken
and mashed potatoes. Yeah. And like we were talking about staying multidisciplinary, you know, I think there's a lot to be learned from delving into other realms, you know, of being an artist who studies welding and understands, you know, oh, that's cool. That's a process I can bring into my piece, you know, in the future to better represent the idea that I want to, you know, transfer.
The more things you can do. My dad was a teacher, and I said the more things you have to define yourself by, the more well-rounded a person you'll be. He taught sixth grade and science and math and history and coached basketball and football and chess and academic team, and he gave guitar lessons, and they would make his students form bands and play in front of the school.
That's awesome.
I mean, he well-rounded the hell out of people.
Yeah. So just in case you're joining us, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on WLXU, and we're in the studio with Lexington artist John Lackey, talking about art and the world and everything. So John, I want to ask you about Homegrown Press and when that started, because I know your studios were up here in the former Spaldings. Now it's where Arcadium is. But before that, how did Homegrown Press come about?
Hitchhiking around and starting to sell my art. When I started screen printing at some point, I can't really remember, because I started doing that in 86 or 87, but I may not have called it Homegrown Press till 88 or 89. So we're coming up on the 30 year of Homegrown Press sometime. And so all the screen printed shirts of my artwork I would make, and block prints and stuff like that, I would put Homegrown Press on the back of the t-shirt, make a separate little logo, and so it's been going on since then. And then when I quit my day job, I guess 15 years ago, I got a Bob Morgan, the wonderful artist and activist here in town, asked me if I wanted a studio at Gallery Soleil. So, I got a studio at Gallery Soleil.
And I think that's the first time I came to visit your studio.
Yeah.
It was up in that orange building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's up above where the Rockledge used to be, up above where Shakespeare and Company is now. Mm-hmm. And Blake Eames had a studio up there, and Lenny Mikowski and Bob and John Reidner and all kinds of characters. Mm. And we had a great time, and I miss having a studio just down the hall from Lennon and Blake.
Yeah.
Because Lennon was a good second pair of eyes to look at stuff and taught me stuff about glazes. And Blake knew what paint or chemical to use for, or tool to use for everything, and she had every tool, and was just fun to talk to. I've known her since she was a little girl, so I miss those days. But that was my first being open to the public as an artist experience. Had a studio there for 7 years, something mm-hmm. like that.
And then after that, you moved up to the north side, right?
Well, after that, you know, they sold it, and I moved out. And so there was a year where I didn't have a studio, and I used to go to Common Grounds Coffee House mm-hmm. and just work there on logos or whatever. And but there was a barista that worked there who was always talking smack about one of her coworkers when she went there, really loud.
Yeah.
And she used the word like 3 times every sentence. Uh-huh. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I thought, well, you know, I've heard about this Third Street stuff. And so I went over to check out Third Street stuff, and I was waiting in line, and the guy in front of me, I was looking, and I thought, is that Richie Havens? The guy who, if you ever seen the movie Woodstock, he's an old folk singer who opened Woodstock.
He wasn't supposed to, right?
Right.
Yeah,
it was just because he just had a guitar, and it was easier to get him there on the helicopter, so they put him on first, and then made him play 3 sets.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't get all the Jefferson Airplane or whoever in.
Unreal.
So he was in line in front of me, and so I sat there talking with him and with Hendrick, who I hadn't really known. Wow. Hendrick Floyd, Shiesty Christ. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Hendrick, one of everybody's favorite people for many good reasons.
Definitely.
So I sat there talking with those two guys, and then sat down and was talking to Richie Havens about 3D artwork. And I thought, well, I think I'm home now, Third wow. Street stuff. And I'd known Pat.
Yeah, Richie Havens and Hendrick, that's quite a duo to
Yeah, that to was kind right of into. A, it's been downhill ever since then. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was a nice moment.
Yeah.
You know, because I love Hendrick, and he's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
But Pat had given me one of my first art jobs when we first started having kids, and mm-hmm. I was trying to find a job. And she gave me a job painting her wooden doohickeys that she used to make, her mm-hmm. pieces of art she would carve out, and then she would hire people to paint them.
Wow.
And she hired people like me. That's why that business didn't, that's why it became a coffee shop.
Less stuff, more coffee.
Well, no, I just wasn't much of a self-starter at that time. I'm like crazed and just keep working, and I'll probably work for a couple of weeks past the time I die.
Mm.
But back then, I, you know, working on your own time, you know, I just wasn't much of a self-starter.
For sure.
And so that didn't last long. And I guess around that same time was when, I guess Eric Sutherland came and asked me if I wanted to do a poster for the first Holler,
mm.
which I guess you encouraged him to do. So it's your fault.
Indeed. That was our conversation. Yeah. Holler Poet Series.
Yeah.
At the Dallas Bar.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it you and him and Jude maybe?
Yeah.
McPherson.
Just being upset about the fifth year anniversary of the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
So we wanted a way to express that we're still upset about this, you know, 5 years later, this endless war, which oddly enough now in 2017,
thank God everything's still, better now.
Yeah. Right. They really figured that out. you know, so we wanted a way to, you know, as poets to express that we're not okay with the way things are happening mm-hmm. still. So that's how Holler Poets started, with Poets for Peace. And I'm so glad that Eric asked you, because all those posters that you created were incredible. And last night when, you know, you gave a speech at 21C as part of the Wildlands event that was organized through Kentucky Natural Lands Trust, that, you know, it was great to see a lot of those posters. And, you know, there's 100 of them. So there's a lot. And
they were labors of love.
Yeah.
Because Eric, I remember him laying it out, and he's so excited. I'm like, this guy's just full of beans, man. And he goes, yeah, we're gonna have this poet series. We'll have it every month. We'll get famous poets and poet laureates, and we'll have musicians, and it'll be this great thing, and people will come. And I'm like, oh, bless his heart.
Yeah.
But I made that first poster and then went to it, and it was just great.
Mm-hmm.
It was just home. It was another home. Like, you find alphas and it's like your home, and then
your
you find
people.
And Holler.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, I'm home again.
Yeah.
And so I just kept making posters every month for free, just because any energy I could put behind that ship. It was such a great ship.
Yeah.
Full of so many great characters.
Truly. And wow. You know, and what all the things that came of that, you know.
Yeah.
Holler Poet series.
I think Sonny Montgomery was born there.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right.
A messy birth on stage.
Yeah, exactly. I think she kept the placenta.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, wow, there's no real segue from that. No, I'm just kidding. So, anyway.
And nothing rhymes with placenta.
It's true. Except for polenta.
Polenta.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, placenta polenta.
Maybe. So, John, so because, I mean, you were doing Holler posters and, you know, so you were coming to Al's and, you know, that's initially how we became friends.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you move into the studio that currently occupies Arcadium?
I guess just on Facebook, I was friends with Griffin Van Meter, and I thought, well, he's like the mayor of this north side that's got all this stuff going on. And I, you know, since my dad taught at Sarah, I grew up on North Lyme.
Mm-hmm.
Sneaking out of school and going to the stores up and down the street, the little general stores, and would see Sweet Evening Breeze in there shopping. It was just an interesting life being on North Lyme. So, and then, you know, moving a couple blocks down to Third Street stuff and hanging out. And then it seemed like a natural thing to try to find something when Gallery Soleil closed. I just wanted a studio space. I really didn't want to have a public space with a front door.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked Griffin, and he showed me some places, and they weren't really right. And he said, well, go talk to Chad Needham.
Mm-hmm.
Who refurbished at great sweat and expense the old Spalding's Bakery that's now Arcadium.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked me into taking that over and making that my studio.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you can do it. And so I said, well, okay.
Yeah. Did it still smell like donuts when you moved in?
At the point he got it, the roof and top floor had caved in, and there was 4 feet of water in the basement.
So probably not.
No, there was bricks.
Yeah.
And that was about it.
Wow.
And he had to jump through tons of hoops to rebuild it to historical whatever classifications mm-hmm. and standards, and he did, and it was a nice place. But I came in kind of in the middle of that, or further down the line, but there was still no bathroom or air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some interesting times.
I don't believe it.
And the donut shop wasn't there. Things were a little different.
Did a lot of people come by thinking that it was still there? Asking you if you sold donuts?
No, it had been
that's good.
Blown out for so long. It had looked like a bombed out building for so long.
Mm-hmm.
People would come tell me stories. Since I didn't have AC, I had the doors open, and I was trying to paint paintings for the one time I did the Woodland Art Fair. I'm a better artist than I am a businessman, so I didn't do the art fair again.
I understand.
I'm just not real organized. But I was trying to paint all these paintings. I was stressed out, and this old man walked in and just started walking around looking at all the paintings propped up against the walls, and I was like, okay, whatever. I'm not really open, but it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to look at art, I'm happy with that because most people don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at all the paintings for a while, and then he walked up to me, and I thought he was going to be friendly. And he goes, those are some awful curly trees. And I thought he was going to compliment my paintings. And before I could say thank you, he goes, real trees aren't that curly.
Wow.
And
everyone's a critic.
And then stared me in the eye, kind of like he was an old man giving me this wisdom that if I straightened out my trees, I'd have something.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I see a really curly ass tree these days, I wish I knew where that guy was so I could say, yes, they are.
Well, that's great. And, you know, I wanted to ask you because, you know, when you moved into that building, the former Spalding's Bakery, you know, the beginning of your film starts there, really. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk to us a little bit and tell people about this film that you're working on, what it's called, and kind of what it all encompasses?
Well, it's called The Great Misfortune, like two words, misfortune. And it just started because I started taking pictures of the liquor store, which is now the you know, Homegrown Press and the donut shop, out the front window of the door of my studio when I was where the Arcadium was, because that building filled up the frame so well, kind of like Van Gogh's Yellow House.
Mm.
And I just started taking pictures, and I dabbled in stop motion photography a little bit, and I just kept taking pictures, and, you know, I would watch, and I was up a little bit above, so I got a lot of sky above it in the photographs, and I could take pictures of storms coming in over the building, and the police horses going by, and fire engines, and people, and you know, and also the refurbishment of the building by my landlord when he bought it to start turning it into whatever it would become. And I had such a good time working on that stop motion movie, and started doing parts where the camera left that and would go to the wall where canvases were, and I would paint cartoons that moved you know, things that happened on the canvases, which is a horrible business plan.
But it looks amazing.
It's beautiful. Hard to go home and look your wife in the eyes when you've been painting a stop motion movie on a canvas like, all day.
I got 15 seconds done today.
Yeah. Oh, 15 seconds.
Is that optimistic?
Yeah. Like 2.3 seconds.
Oh, wow.
And so I just kept working on that. And eventually I spent so much time on it, I couldn't afford that place anymore. And I considered it a real failure when I had to move across the street into the smaller space next to the donut shop. And really, in the end, like most things you think are a mistake or a problem, there's a real silver lining. And that place is much quieter and more conducive and has better acoustics. And I felt kind of bad taking up that whole Arcadium space by myself. It should be a bunch of people in there drinking beers and cutting up and playing video games and shooting the breeze and enjoying the beautiful hardwood floors. My landlord, Chad, he had a portable tree miller, or a wood mill at the time, and he got some cherry and pine trees that went down in the ice storm, and he milled them into the wood that you see on the floors of the Arcadium, and the facade is cherry from trees that he milled himself.
Wow, that's crazy.
There's a Renaissance man.
Yeah, I didn't know that all that had gone into the restoration.
Yeah, and like two or three separate ceilings in between the second and first floors and all this code stuff he had to do, and he did it right. It's really beautiful. So it's nice that lots of people get it to go in there, and it's a bar instead of just one nutty guy in a in a studio, you know.
Well,
so it worked out good. So I kept the movie going once I moved across the street, and I had a 25th anniversary of Homegrown Press, and I only had an hour to work on it because I was working on freelance trying to make money. So I got a six pack and a stapler and just stapled a bunch of posters to the wall. And I could have considered that a huge failure. But instead I started taking the staples out and putting in thumbtacks and moving the pieces around and kept shooting it with my camera to make it be part of the animated movie. And then the big giant whale that those posters became kind of flew off in the movie, got carried off by a crow that was made up out of posters. And the painting all filled in, the mural that you see on the wall now filled in as part of the movie. Kind of like the freelance was leaving, now it was time for me to just be an artist and say what I got to say. Because you raise a couple of kids or just become a middle-aged man who's paying attention to the world, you got a whole lot more to say. There's a lot more that needs to come out of you than when you were young. And you're like, what do I need to make art about? I have no idea what to do when you're young. I always tell young people, it's like, you'll have plenty of ideas. Just keep practicing. When you get old, you'll realize you've got a lot more ideas than you got years left. So, you know, momentum will come if you just keep pedaling.
Yeah. And John, so if people want to go see this film, where can people watch it at?
Well, you can look on my Facebook page, John Lackey, or I have a Homegrown Press Facebook page, but I don't put much on it because Facebook, if you're a business page, wants you to buy ads so people can see your stuff. So maybe a 20th of the people that see your posts on your home on your personal page see it on your business page. And I have a website that I haven't updated in a while. I need to get back on it, but it's homegrownpress.com, and it's got years worth of old stuff. I need to update it pretty badly, but I'm doing logos and posters for people and good causes and things. I'm on a couple of boards, and I'm starting to really kind of hum with a painting after all these years. It's starting to become a loft. So
yeah, and I know you
times are busy.
Yeah, and you do a lot of, you know, landscape parts of, you know, places in Kentucky, with just incredible vivid colors, but also a lot of printmaking and a lot of designs for books, right? So can you talk a little bit about just some of the logos and some of the clients that you work with?
Well, another home is Larkspur Press, Gray Zeitz out in Monterey, Kentucky, up north of Frankfort. He, if you don't know about him, check him out, because, you know, there's increasingly less rare birds like that in the world.
Handmade books.
I mean, they get the paper and they hand set all the type, and they hire people like me to make wood engravings for the covers and the insides. And he does a lot of stuff with Wendell Berry's. Most people know or should know about Wendell Berry and his writings. A lot of people love him for his essays and then some for his poetry. I like him for his fiction because it combines the essays and the poetry, I think. Mm-hmm. So Wesley Bates does all the wood engravings for his books, and Wesley is this beautiful person from Canada who comes down and teaches a wood engraving workshop up there every Halloween weekend.
At Larkspur Press.
And so we go there and cut up. That's where I met Richard Taylor, former poet laureate of Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Great, great poet and beautiful bon vivant. Mm-hmm. And I guess he's a monk, if not a preacher, at the Church of the Elkhorn.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it just means a loose connections of a loose collection of canoes and kayaks on the Elkhorn.
I see. The real church.
Yeah.
Where nature convenes.
Yeah. And he writes beautiful sonnets. I never thought I'd be a fan of sonnets. Mm. His sonnet, he's tight. He's so good. He's academically sound, but then beyond that, he's just a great poet. And I got to meet him through there. He was just Richard sitting across from me at the wood engraving workshop, and we were cutting up and drinking bourbon.
Mm-hmm. Cutting it up.
For a day or
literally.
Two. Yeah. Didn't. Before I realized that was, somebody goes, well, yeah, that's Richard Taylor, the poet laureate. Mm. And I'm like, oh, because I knew him and knew his work, but I didn't know that guy cutting up with me was him.
Wow.
It was nice to meet him just as Richard. And then I've done a couple of book covers and illustrations for, and a broadside illustration for the poetry of Eric Reese, who's a great nonfiction writer and professor here in Kentucky. But his books of poetry through Larkspur Press.
That's great. And you've also done a lot of album covers, right?
I've done a couple of album covers for people in Kentucky, block printed. Mm-hmm. And then I used to do a lot of posters for the band Wilco. Mm-hmm. And a few for Jeff Tweedy solo. And that was another, I mean, that's a bigger, looser family, but it is a family.
Yeah, so how did that connection with Wilco come about?
I just really liked Wilco.
Yeah, they're amazing, yeah.
Yeah, I just thought he was the patron saint of manic depression. Mm-hmm. He was a crazy guy whose horrible migraines had led him down the road of addiction.
Yeah.
And he fought, you know, he kept raising the bar of artistic achievement throughout that. You know, he wouldn't live real long if he had kept that. And, you know, I thought you had to be crazy to make art, and it helped me. Mm-hmm. And I got online to get tickets for a Wilco show and met all these people who were Wilco fans, and some of them had little living room concerts in Chicago where they raised money for not so well-to-do kids in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And Tweedy played those shows, and so I did a couple of posters for that, and I spent 2 weeks on one because, you know, he was one of my favorite songwriters, yeah, artistic hero. And his wife saw it and liked it and showed it to Wilco, so they had me start doing posters for him.
It's awesome.
And, yeah, it was very awesome.
Yeah. How big of a role do you think you would say music plays in your art? You know, because I feel like every time I'm in your studio, you know, you've got music going, you know, and...
This is a horrible analogy because I have increasingly so many friends that are vegetarians. Mm-hmm. But it would... Me trying to make my art without music, it seems like it'd be trying to make sausage without pigs or chickens or whatever, you know,
yeah,
or even soybeans, whatever you make sausage out of these days. Mm-hmm. It's just raw emotional material that gets me in the mood. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I could get in the mood without music. Sometimes if I'm playing an album, if I really get into it and the album ends, I can go for a couple hours if nothing breaks the spell.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the pig.
Yeah, it's the pig. True.
I'm sorry, all my vegetarian friends.
It's okay. I'm vegetarian.
But I'm sorry, we forget.
It's okay. I'm not.
It's a metaphorical.
I still love you, John. So, you know, I think, and with music too, I think inspiration, and particularly folks who make a profession out of creative venues, you know, you have to have inspiration, you know, come from somewhere. And I know music is a huge part of it to you, but like you spoke to last night at 21C, you know, running is also a huge part of inspiring you to create, right? So can
trail
you talk
a
little bit about kind of trail running and what that's done to improve your artistic process?
Yeah, it just the boiling cauldron, the world is kind of becoming, the stress level's kind of high, and trying to wear all the hats and do all the different kinds of art I do for different things. You know, I'm no spring chicken, and it's starting to get to me. So, Yeah, I had a burst appendix 3 years ago and was in bed for a month after that, after the surgery for that. And afterwards had no energy. I hadn't made art, which is what keeps me sane and pays the bills. And I was broke and getting ready to lose my studio. And so I would go out to Raven Run to go hike every Monday. And at first I couldn't hike a couple hundred feet. It is the energy level you have after a surgery. I had no idea. It was my first one. Mm-hmm. And I just kept going back out every Monday and making myself do that just to have to start the week off with at least seeing some nature. And then one day the stress, I got a little stronger than the stress of possibly losing my studio and having no artistic momentum got to me. And I started running down a hill because it was easier than walking with my old knees. And when I got to the bottom and crested, hopped the creek and started going, let the momentum carry me back up the other side and just started trail running for the first time since cross country meets in high school in 1980. Mm. And just started doing it every Monday, just, and at first it was just in Keen sandals and, whatever I was wearing. And over the past couple of years, I finally bought some trail running shoes mm-hmm. and some athletic shorts, because when I was just running in regular clothes, big old gray bearded guy mm-hmm. running, I always come upon people with children and they cling to their parents and they'd look behind me to see what I was running from and wonder why I wasn't running faster.
Wow.
But I do it every Monday and every Monday morning, and it makes me sane and sets my, it takes my oh hell energy, mm-hmm. like oh hell the world and all the stuff I got to do and just anxiety, and it turns it into hell yeah.
Yeah.
If I get a good run in, I come back out of it, and I might see some animals or talk to some turkeys or, mm-hmm. Do some deer whispering, mm-hmm. but mainly I'm just staring at the trail, 55 minute run, and then come home and eat something vegetarian and take a shower and go to work. And it starts my week off with a bang. Mm-hmm. And, I won't be able to do it forever. I'm going to be 55 this weekend. So running 4 miles on really, really up and down trails with lots of roots and rocks, probably the smartest thing to do, but
man, if it doesn't help sort out the clutter.
Yeah. I don't want to have to go to the Y and work out. I'm already inside all the time, mm-hmm. but plus it's, with our jobs, it's nice to be by yourself mm-hmm. in your thoughts. It's nice to go your own, go to the beat of your own drummer, because art is supposed to be unique, mm-hmm. and we have to, so I never really want to go do what everybody else is doing. Yeah. So it makes it kind of lonely, but it's good for your job. Mm-hmm. It's good for your artistic mind.
Yeah.
So to go and use a bunch of machines with a bunch of people, it's eventually what I'm going to have to end up doing, and it'll be cool. It'll be fun. Mm-hmm. I used to be an athlete. We worked out, and it was a long time ago, but it's nice to just do your own thing, mm-hmm.
Get out there.
Be a contrarian and keep it pure.
Yeah, reconvene with nature, where yeah. we all came from.
Yeah.
It's important.
Ozark Mountain Daredevils.
It's true.
Got to get back to the country, because it's where we all come from.
It's very true. Ain't that the truth?
Mm-hmm. That's why we need to protect the country.
It's very true, and our natural resources.
Yeah.
Well, John, I think you've succeeded in that. I think anyone who sees your work, whether it be in a Larkspur Press book or on the wall at West 6 or, wherever it might be, I think people can recognize your uniqueness, the uniqueness that you bring to the brush. Your curvy trees, as you say, I'm glad. Keep them curvy. That guy doesn't know what he's talking about.
The world's getting weird enough. I may not be able to paint trees much longer.
They might, someone might come across and be like, trees are actually curvier than that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's the truth.
Yeah.
And you get older and you start thinking about what you might leave behind. And I think about when I was a young person and first came across big, thick books of M.C. Escher's artwork, mm-hmm. and the bar he set on every piece just about. I mean, he really went to town on everything, and it sets the bar so high for younger people. You want a solid body of work to mm-hmm. be left behind,
yeah.
to show what's possible.
Yeah.
You know?
If you're going to do it, do it all the way.
Go for it.
Yeah. Well, John,
trademark.
trademark, hashtag homegrown press. Well, John, it's been awesome having you in, have a conversation and talk. And it's always just awesome to hang out with you.
Always, anytime. Always, brother.
Definitely. Always. So I would encourage those other folks out there listening to come up North Limestone. You can check out Homegrown Press right there on the corner of 6th and Limestone, to the left of North Lime Coffee and Donuts. So when you get your iced coffee or whatever you do, in the, your butter coffee, whatever you get, you can come on by and peek your head in the studios and check out the art in John's studio.
Please do.
Sorry. Well, John, can you let people know kind of where they can go to see some of your artwork and if you have any shows coming up?
I have a show in Frankfurt at the Grand Theater in October or November. I need to get with Larry and ask him. Just online, Facebook, Instagram, I'm at Homegrown Press. That's probably the best place because you don't have to hear me rambling about politics and whining about stuff or pictures of my dog. So Instagram at Homegrown Press. That's Instagram is just the greatest thing. Mm-hmm. If the world was my Instagram feed, it'd just be full of dancers and South American mural artists and lovely people that we all know, and musicians and travelers and those crazy people that just go around taking pictures of mountains.
Yeah.
God bless them.
I know.
Hate them.
Yeah. That's
true. But I appreciate their work.
Yeah. It's nice to travel with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's great. Yeah. Well, John, well, thanks again for coming in. And just in case you've been listening, we've been talking with Lexington artist John Lackey, owner and creator of Homegrown Press, which is about to celebrate their 30th anniversary coming up. And a happy early birthday, John.
Grazie.
Yeah, de nada. Sweet. So nonetheless, we're going to wrap things up here. Ricerone University is up next. But thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Have a good one, and stay dry if you can. Catch you later. Adios.